Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and as usual, with me is James.
Hi.
Before we get started, I want to get you to check out our website, themacguffinman.com, for all our old content. Earlier this week, we talked about Super Bowl 49. Last week, we talked about Top Gun, and the week before that, we talked about Inherent Vice. Also follow us on Twitter to keep up to date with our most recent shenanigans on the podcast. And yeah, tell your friends about us. And that seems to be about it. So we'll just get right to it.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Mm-hmm.
What's the password?
Fidelio.
No, that was the password for admittance. You're already in.
Oh, God. I like his pronunciation of Fidelio, though.
Wait, who? The
Tom Cruise puts a little Italian flair on it.
Puts a little stank on it?
Yeah. Whatever Italian for stank.
Oh, does he does he say Fidelio?
It's a little.
It's a little fox catchery.
A little something going on. Fidelio.
Yeah.
No, we're talking, to answer a question you didn't ask, we're talking about Eyes Wide Shut today.
I said that question in lieu of the question you just answered.
I figured. Yeah. Another Stanley Kubrick film for us.
Mm-hmm.
Notably Stanley Kubrick's last film.
Notably, yes. Unless you count AI, which nobody does.
Do we? Why would we?
He's a producer on it, and I don't know. The when I saw the Kubrick exhibit at TIFF, there seemed to be a lot more focus on AI than I expected.
No. Yeah. This is his real last movie.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
I guess he submitted a cut like 4 days before his death.
Yeah, it's a real Charles Schultz situation here.
Yeah.
So.
But this was, Stanley Kubrick, obviously, a very, very important, influential director. And I hadn't seen this movie until just recently for this podcast. Mm-hmm. But in 1999, I was, 12 years old and not as into movies now. And I still remember what a big deal this was coming out,
mm-hmm.
which is really weird to me, considering, how few movies stand out that way. Like, I remember this being on the cover of Time magazine and not really having a concept of who Kubrick was.
Because, yeah, the last time he put a movie was the year you were born.
Yeah, and I just mean, I obviously was not the target demographic when this movie came out. So, it wouldn't have been advertised directly to me or anything. But I still remember this being just a very... big release, like it's just a really big topic in mainstream culture, not just cinephile circles.
Yeah, for sure. And a big part of that has to do with the fact that Tom Cruise is in this movie. Tom Cruise in 1999, no less.
And Nicole Kidman.
Yeah, exactly. But Cruise is much more important, I think. He's a much bigger star. It's
right.
It's his famous wife as well that adds an extra element. One thing I found really interesting, I mentioned the Kubrick exhibit, they have a bunch of posters for Eyes Wide Shut, so I was looking at those, and I love that it was Cruise, Kidman, Kubrick all above the title.
Really?
I really enjoyed that. And yeah, that's the type of thing you're talking about when Kubrick puts out a movie. It's that I've never seen a director's name so big that it is listed two rows under Tom Cruise before the title of the film,
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
And not even like a Stanley Kubrick film, but just Kubrick.
Kubrick, yeah. So, it's the combination, as you said, Cruise is definitely the bigger star, but it certainly bears mentioning that they were just, the Hollywood power couple at the time.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And so it's, the combination of Tom Cruise being a huge star, Nicole Kidman being his wife at the time and being a star on her own,
mm-hmm.
Plus Kubrick, as I said, a very, very important director. And, a lot of times I've found in looking at people's review of Kubrick movies that maybe at the time they're released, they're not as well received, but give them 5-10 years and suddenly, they're masterpieces.
Yeah.
That happens with you know, one or two movies for a lot of directors, but it seems to be a pattern in his filmography.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very much a pattern. And, you know, you, if you kind of look at his movies now, they're all so different. And that's kind of a big part of that, because critics, like when they go into a movie, they have some sort of idea of what they expect out of it. Critics, as with anybody, if things subvert their expectations so much that it sort of starts to make them feel weird, and these critics also probably have to turn around their reviews pretty quickly. So, and Kubrick especially, his movies tend to, more thought tends to help them. You know, like my opinion on Eyes Wide Shut was much different 2 days after I had first watched Eyes Wide Shut. You know, like my take on it had changed, and not entirely. Like, I liked the movie when I first saw it, and then 2 days later, as I was still thinking about it, I was like, oh, I really like this movie. You know, and yeah, when you're kind of being so different, often it's kind of hard to take initially. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, yeah, for sure. And go ahead.
This movie and a lot of Kubrick movies in general, they're very tonally bizarre. You know, like there's a tone to a Kubrick movie that is pretty much entirely different from whatever was going on in film at the time. Like, imagine watching Dr. Strangelove in 1966 or whenever that came out, you know, like watching, if that movie came out today unchanged, it would be reviewed just as well as everybody thinks it is. That movie's amazing, right? But yeah. In 1966, that must have seemed just so insanely bizarre, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I bring up kind of that delay in the critical appreciation of his movies to say, you know, as you said, it was like something like 12 years before he had, since he had released a movie. Mm-hmm. So we kind of, you know, we've had that distance from the last one. Like, we've, this is not just another Kubrick movie, but this is a late Kubrick movie after he's kind of developed all this, all this appreciation, and kind of was a really legendary figure in filmmaking by this point. So, you know, it's not just any period Kubrick. It's, I think, when the people probably had the most mm-hmm. appreciation for what he did.
Yep, for sure.
maybe since his death, but I mean, up until that point, I think this would have been kind of the time there would have been the most. So the combination of this power couple, Kubrick being who he was and given the time period, and then plus the enormous amount of secrecy that went on with this movie, I think is what, you know, made the release of it such a big deal that I can still remember things about a movie that I hadn't seen until like this week. You know
yeah,
what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And part of that secrecy is the fact that, the further Kubrick got into his life, the more reclusive he got. And, you know, by the time Eyes Wide Shut comes out, people didn't really know what Kubrick looked like anymore, because he, you know, he sort of stopped publicity stills of himself from existing and didn't make any public appearances.
Yeah. Just look at the clouds in The Shining if you want to know what Stanley Kubrick looks like.
Well, even those clouds only show him in 1980. You know, yeah, 19 years have passed, right?
True,
I mean,
true.
We'll Photoshop it in later. But yeah, no, he was, he got more and more reclusive as time went on, and even more so as this movie was coming out. And it's funny, actually. There's a documentary about Stanley Kubrick called A Life in Pictures. It's directed by his producing partner, Jan Harlan. So you've got to take, you know, all the niceties of it with kind of a grain of salt. But one of his daughters talks about how, you know, he dies before the promotional tour of Eyes Wide Shut. And Kubrick had talked about with this daughter, I forget which one, but about kind of coming out in public and sort of talking, you know, talking for the first time in a long time, yeah. Because he sort of felt like since he was reclusive, people were making up their own stories about him. And he kind of wanted to set the record straight that he wasn't this perfectionist lunatic, definitely a perfectionist and at least half a lunatic. But
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like that he wasn't this cold, cold-hearted, there's just no human element to him. You know, he kind of got tired of the way he was being discussed, I think, eventually.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes his death even sadder.
Yeah, well, I think it helps that he never talked about his movies. I do think it helps that he died before he had a chance to talk again. I think it helps, like, his legacy, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, say, I know I've compared them a lot recently, but in our Inherent Vice podcast, we've talked about how I think PTA is just trying, Paul Thomas Anderson is just trying to make Eyes Wide Shut now. Or, you know, that style of movie. And I loved listening to Paul Thomas Anderson do all the interviews in his Inherent Vice press run, but I don't think it helped his legacy. You know, I don't think it helped anybody think more deeply about his films, because he just sort of started talking like every other director talks about his movies, whereas he was the guy that was sort of held, as far as Americans, held slightly higher in regard, you know, partially because he didn't really talk about his movies all that much for the last decade.
Okay. Yeah. And you think that would have been, that's pretty Kubrickian.
Yeah, exactly. The fact that we never got to see Kubrick as a human helps him remain this person that we get to make up all these things about, you know, which yeah. we then project onto the films ourselves.
Yeah. we do get some of the typical stories of Kubrick perfectionism on this too.
Like, oh yeah.
it's not everything has changed in his life.
Yeah. I mean, this movie was in production for 2 years, I believe, right?
Yeah, something around there. Guinness record for longest continual shoot. Like there's movies that kind of develop in hell and go on and off, but he was shooting at like, I think 400 straight days, which is pretty incredible.
yeah, that is. And,
and Kidman and crew, like, this wasn't, this is very, very late in the Kubrick career. It's the latest, if you don't count AI. Mm-hmm. The stories of him being a perfectionist, things running over, we're certainly common knowledge at this point. And Kidman and crew signed open-ended contracts when they flew the production to Britain, where Kubrick lived, and demanded they shoot this movie despite it being set in New York. Vincent D'Onofrio, who worked on Full Metal Jacket with Kubrick, said, you know, like, you better rent a house or an apartment. You're going to be there a while.
Yeah.
It wasn't obviously people knew the way Kubrick worked, but Cruise and Kidman just really, really want to work with him and knew he was a very talented director and kind of did what they needed to do in order to make this project what he wanted it to be.
Yeah, and this is one, that fact about Tom Cruise is like one of my favorite Tom Cruise facts. I find that so great that like at the height of his fame, he's just like, yeah, okay, Kubrick, do what you want with me. You know,
I'll give you 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Kidman as well, to a lesser extent, just because she's not the same size of star, but this is a big part of Tom Cruise's, you know, he would do Top Gun, he would do Cocktail, and then he'd do Born on the 4th of July, you know, Born on the 4th of July, to sort of make sure he had that critical cred always. And even though he was making these big blockbuster movies, like we talked about Top Gun last week, after Top Gun, he goes right to the set of The Color of Money because he wanted to be in a Scorsese movie, you know, and with Paul Newman, he wanted to be considered part of this elite, this Hollywood elite. And you can see that all through his career, especially with Eyes Wide Shut and Magnolia, working with the old master and the hypothetical new master coming up, he really sort of cared about making sure that people, even if they didn't like him in these films, saw him in these films that are considered, you know, classier works than Top Gun or, people erroneously like Jerry Maguire. or Mission Impossible, even though Mission Impossible is probably a better movie than most people give it credit for, you know, but he wanted to be seen in sort of these artsier films every once in a while.
Yeah. And I, like, even just reading reviews for this movie, you know, some written at the time, some written, you know, much after the fact, like on a 15th anniversary or a Blu-ray release or something. There still is like I saw the word frat boy come up with Tom Cruise a lot. I know. It's like, and I just, that's kind of just being the, you know, being as good looking and as famous as he was and Top Gun being a hit it was for him being kind of the cowboy. I almost said Maverick. I think that's kind of what you're getting at. He's the feeling of he could easily be pigeonholed, but he wants to do something with everyone great. He wants to do a more artistic thing once in a while, so he's not so pigeonholed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you kind of laughed when I said Kubrick was still a perfectionist on this one. Is there a particular story you were thinking of?
Well, no, I was just thinking of the New York street sets. which I love. I love in this movie how.
Yeah, we'll talk about the sets of it.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, I mean, they rebuilt streets in New York in Pinewood Studios in England just because Kubrick was terrified of flying. And also, you know, like we've talked about, had the credibility to make these films come to him. Because he could construct these things. And he sent photographers to New York to photograph every inch of these streets, and then they would rebuild them. There's a really fascinating short documentary. It's about 45 minutes. It's on Vimeo. It's called Stanley Kubrick's Boxes. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Okay. Amazing. It's this documentary filmmaker goes into Stanley Kubrick's archives. Like, it's called Stanley Kubrick's Boxes because it's all these cardboard boxes and just filled with... there's a lot of research for Eyes Wide Shut, but it goes back throughout his entire career, more or less, up until about the mid-60s, and then before then gets a little sketchy. But it's so fascinating. He's just going through all the pre-production stuff for some of his movies, and Eyes Wide Shut specifically, I believe it's his son-in-law, I think. No, it's Jan Harlan's son. So his nephew, wait, I don't know. Whatever, it doesn't matter. Jan Harlan's son had to photograph all of these places in London, trying to find like a doorway that looked like a good spot for the prostitute in Eyes Wide Shut to live, and Vanessa Shaw's character. And he would take these pictures and then call Stanley Kubrick and be like, yeah, I think I found something. And he's like, well, bring it over as quickly as you can. I need to see it immediately. And also the way he had to photograph the streets was so funny. He's like, I need you to be on a ladder on this rung and facing in this perspective. And he estimates that he took like 30,000 photos over the course of the pre-production of Eyes Wide Shut, just trying to find perfect spaces.
Wow.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. And I saw, like, you know, you said that he would fly people over there to... you know, like measure the width of streets and mark down exactly where like a newspaper box would be, like just things that would be so, so specific. And he just needed that, like, as you know, he just always required that level of authenticity and perfection.
Yeah. And I think it also, I mean, because they are, I don't want to say they're obviously sets, but they do look like sets. They look like really good sets. But they still don't look like a city street, you know? And I think that kind of adds something to this movie, because they don't quite look realistic. Like, I don't know, it kind of takes you out of it a bit. It kind of confuses you a little. And I do think that adds a little something to the movie. And I certainly like that about it. Yeah.
Oh, no, it's got like another word in a lot of people's reviews and descriptions of this movie is dream or dreamlike. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of, as you're saying, like that just a little bit off, like so accurate in so many ways, so like specific down to millimeters, but then still not right. Mm-hmm. I think it's that dream feeling of like when you try to tell your dream to someone, you're like, hey, we're at your house, but it's not your house, but we know it's your house, even though it doesn't look like it. Like it's that kind of incongruity that like everything seems right, but there's still something off. Yeah. I think that's... you can tie that into so many themes of this movie of a marriage not quite that is perfect but isn't quite perfect as it seems. Mm-hmm. You know, his life, everything that goes on at these parties that he thinks he has an idea of, and then it's something else. And just the idea of truth in this movie. There's so many things that are said and never confirmed, and so many things that are put out there, accepted as fact, and without real evidence. Mm-hmm. I don't know, that happens a weird amount of times in this movie, and like on major plot points. So
yeah, just one quick note on Kubrick's perfectionism just before we move on to actually talking about the film, which I think it's about time we do that. It can't be understated how important it is that he had Warner Brothers financial backing for the entirety of his career. Like Warner Brothers, I mean, charity case is a bad way to describe it, but they just sort of... It didn't matter what Kubrick was going to do. He had the money, you know, he had Warner Brothers money. They just sort of supported him. And they were like, this is worth it. You know, it's worth it to be the studio that produced Stanley Kubrick's movies. And that's something that, you know, directors in that sort of artsier type world, they still have to scrounge for money, especially now, to get their movies made. And Kubrick never had that. So that allowed him to be the perfectionist he was. He was also kind of smart financially. Like early on in his career, he purchased and refurbished this really a camera that he then subsequently used on everything that he shot, so that he didn't have to rent things. He bought equipment early on in his career and wouldn't have to worry about the rental fees from that point on. So I mean, you're still paying for the film that you're shooting, but you don't have to pay the physical rental fee for the camera and the lenses,
or the extra $200 on top of the rental fee. That's yeah. What jokes.
Yeah, no, I got it. Okay. I think that Warner Brothers support is really important to note for helping to make Kubrick's career be what it is, because I think he would have struggled a lot more if he didn't have their support for his career, you know?
Yeah, and I'm certain Warner Brothers didn't want Stanley Kubrick to die after making this, but I think, you know, to say you're the studio that was with this great director to the end, you mm-hmm. know, not that they knew it would be or wanted it to be, obviously, but, you know, that looks good on you. And I know it's kind of a cold, calculating way to think, but, you know, for a studio like that, it does look good, you know, for the same reason they do prestige pictures, not just to make money, but you know, to give themselves that prestige. I think doing whatever this guy wanted because he was so clearly talented and so respected, you know, just puts them in that certain kind of light that I can imagine they would want to be in.
Yeah, and it's interesting now because it seems like Warner Brothers is the studio that does the least of that now. Like yeah. they make the least, or they're kind of always sort of gunning for commercial success. But I don't know. It deserves mentioning, I think.
Yeah, and you know, allowing him to did you hear the story about the sound of a window being knocked on in this movie?
No. I'm so excited though.
So I couldn't get any details on what. So maybe this is just another kind of Kubrick myth, but he was unhappy with he had a shot of someone knocking on a window and he was fine with it visually, but he didn't like the sound of the knock. Mm-hmm. And so instead of just using a stand-in to get that sound in a recording booth, he flew the actor back out to the window to get his exact, like, knocking method. I don't know.
That's so funny.
Yeah, no, if that's true, that's one of my favorite Kubrick perfectionist stories, of which there are dozens. So
yeah, I'm going to give that a 60-40 chance of being true. Because it sounds so insane, but Kubrick makes it 60%. Yeah,
no, I know. And that's just... you know, with being a legendary director, that's kind of things that will follow you. It's stories like that, whether they're true or not, are going to just become part of what people think of when they think of your name.
Exactly. And since they never had a personality to attach to. Okay. So what did you think about this movie? We're at the 23 minute mark.
Yeah, no, I think it's time. Well, actually, I think I found my new favorite Christmas movie. Like, I think I know what the new Christmas tradition in my family is going to be, getting everyone together and watching this movie.
So what you're saying is you just saw Surviving Christmas for the first time with Ben Affleck and James Gandolfini?
That's right. Yeah. No, I think this is one of those movies. I think it's time we develop a word for it, but kind of more fun to think about than watch. Hmm. I don't know if you want to call them noodle bakers or what, but no, I think it's... other than the orgy quasi-religious ritual scene, which is pretty bizarre, it's actually a much more kind of grounded and normal movie than I was anticipating. Like, okay. I was always told that this was a really, really wild movie. And, you know, we've talked about it being described as kind of dreamlike. And, you know, obviously that scene in the mansion is not a part of life that I recognize from experience. But I think just thematically, this is mostly about small things like jealousy and trust and relationships and things like that. And I think it puts a lot of really interesting ideas forward. Mm-hmm. And we talked about it with Inherent Vice, and I think we'll talk about it with this one, but it's a very much an atmosphere kind of movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
You know, I kind of, again, wanted to get your opinion on how it is they always achieve that. But I think it works, and I think it is, I just said it, like, it is kind of grounded. It is, in its ideas, pretty grounded, but in the storytelling, I think... you do have a lot of questions of, you know, what's actually happening, what part of this might be imagined by someone. So it just does have a very ethereal kind of tone to the whole thing, which is pulled off really well. And I can't think of a lot of other movies that have done that for me.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I mean,
what did you think?
Oh, I love this movie.
Yeah.
If there's a Room 237 movie ever made about this film, do not be surprised if I end up being one of the subjects in that movie. I love this movie. It's I find it so interesting, and yeah, like I've recently watched all of Kubrick's movies, the ones I hadn't seen, and rewatched the ones I had seen, and I think this is my favorite. Like I really think that, and I know that's not the common opinion, but I really love it. I love movies with that sort of atmosphere. We talked about it a lot with The Shining, which I think there's a lot of stylistic similarities between The Shining and Eyes Wide Shut, because they sort of, what we talked about a lot with The Shining was there's a lot of room to breathe physically in the space between Jack Nicholson and the walls of the Overlook Hotel that he's walking through, those long sort of slowly moving steady cam shots where we're just sort of following our main character through a location, and that it's just sort of, it's this journey, and it is about small things, but it's about small things that I really like thinking about. And especially with Eyes Wide Shut, there's such a, like, the symmetry of just the construction of Eyes Wide Shut makes me so happy. Especially like the first few scenes mixed with the last few scenes. It's almost like a mirror.
What do you mean by that symmetry?
Okay, well, the film starts with this sort of like, the shot of Nicole Kidman getting undressed, and that's sort of to set up the voyeur aspect of what Tom Cruise will end up doing later in the film. We just sort of get this quick shot, and then it's sort of taken away from us before we feel like we're done. It's like closing a shade, and then we get the Eyes Wide Shut title card. But starting the first real scene we get is Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, the Harfords, getting ready to go to this party, and then we get them in the living room talking to the babysitter. They go to this party, and then we get the Mandy interlude, shall we say. And the end of the movie is, all about coming home. He goes from Mandy's corpse to right to Sidney Pollack's house where the party happened, and then goes to returns home and to the living room where they have their talk, and then they go to the toy store for the sort of epilogue scene. And throughout the movie, it's not perfect. It's not perfect symmetry. I admit that immediately. But it's kind of this build to this one place, the Fidelio party, the mansion, and then going back through all of these places again to find what's changed since you've last been there. And I don't know. I just find it so interesting because, you know, we get everything at night and then everything in day, and or, you know, like a return, even if it ends up being at night. I don't know. There's just something so interesting about that, about this guy going through all of these things, having this really weird night, to put it mildly, and then sort of revisiting all of those places where these odd things happen to you. I don't know. I just find it so fascinating.
Yeah. And a lot of the times when he goes through them again, he doesn't get answers. And he's even to the point where he's often not even able to access what he thought he'd be able to get information from. You know what I mean? Like, he can't find Nick anymore. He goes to the rainbow room, and it's like he can't get in there, or rainbow costumes, whatever that place is called. Yeah, and that's what I was getting at before with this idea of all these things being kind of presented and unable to be confirmed. Like all these major plot points of people's life, like, you know, what happened to Nick, Ziegler's explanation of what happens to the beauty queen, Domino's HIV, the news of that comes from someone else and we don't hear it from Domino or hear from Domino or see that again. The way in, then he goes back to the house and he can't get in. There's just all these things out there. And then he, you know, as you said, he tries to return to all these ideas. He tries to, I think, verify a lot of these things and is unable to. And that, I think, is another part of the dream like atmosphere of this movie. Like the second you try to, you know, utilize something in your dream, like you wake up, or the second you try to, like, or when you wake up and you try to go back over your dream, like you get that feeling like it's quickly fading. And yeah. I mean, there's I could take some dialogue from Inception right now too that is kind of the exact same thing. But I think that's another of the big dream the feeling that this movie gives. Is like you've experienced something and then you try to grasp it, you try to like get a hold on it and make sense of it, and it's, you know, ephemeral, it's gone by the time you can try to piece things together. And that's what it ties into what I think you're saying about him returning to all these things in the second half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also kind of this idea of nothing is actually how it seemed in your memory or how it seemed in first glance, kind of like even just, you know, your perspective of what marriage is going to be when you first enter it. It changes over time, you know, like as things progress. And yeah, I think that's great. And I mean, from the structure element, and I think the filmmaking is more or less flawless in this film. But also the fact that it is something interesting beyond just the structure. It's that idea of going back to these places where these things happened and seeing them in a totally different light, you know?
Yeah, and Kubrick very famously has movies that can be very, very easily divided into two parts. Like Full Metal Jacket, you have training and then you have the war. Like there's a clear demarcation. I mean, in Full Metal Jacket, we lose our protagonist. Like the first half, you think it's going to be about Private Pyle, whatever his real name is. Mm-hmm. And then he kills himself. And now Joker is pretty much our protagonist. And we have thematically a lot of the same things, some of the same characters, obviously the same. It's still the Vietnam War that we're concerned with. But it's a much different movie. And what's the other big one where he does that?
I don't know.
I thought there's another one that's really
Clockwork Orange is kind of
yes, absolutely. Clockwork Orange is the other one. A very kind of different feel from the first half and the other. Yeah. And this one, it's not as stark a contrast, but you know, it's still two clear parts. And a lot of movies are most easily divided into three parts. And I think Kubrick's are most often, not most often, but some of them definitely two parts. And this one doesn't have that crazy transition. I mean, you don't lose your main character. We don't change settings significantly. Actually, we just kind of go to all the same settings we went to in the first one, in the first half. So it's not as stark as contrast between the two parts, but it still is there. And I think that's another just trademark of Kubrick for me.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
What do you make of his revisit, or at least attempting almost revisit, to the patient's daughter, when that patient dies and he goes to their house? And I think all we get in the second half of that is him calling the house and not even speaking to her boyfriend.
Yeah.
Or husband.
Yeah. And I think that's such a brief moment. I think it's sort of like this very brief sort of, I don't know, lapse in judgment that the boyfriend shakes him out of, because he knows he could have sex with Marion, and I think that's why he's calling. And then he just sort of gets this reminder that there's more to it than just him having sex with this woman. It's that he's going to hurt something. He's not just going to get joy out of it. He's going to hurt something else apart from him, you know? I think that's what that is.
Domino effect.
Yeah, sure.
Can I ask you why Bill's always confirming that he's a doctor? That seems to be a line that's repeated more often than I think is warranted.
And flashing his badge, his doctor badge?
His doctor badge.
I think it's meant to be, because I think there's supposed to be a, or at least this is the way I feel about it. We're supposed to see Nick and Bill as two people that came from the same place and went in different ways, right? Mm-hmm. They both went to med school. Nick didn't finish. He left and became a musician. And Bill kept going and is now a doctor and a responsible family man. And Nick has a family. He discusses it, but he kind of has this sort of like, I don't know, vagrant might be too strong of a word, but this sort of vagrant sort of life where he moves from place to place, he's got to go where the work is, right?
Yeah, exactly. He very clearly states he's just kind of being acted upon, like just kind of going, going where he needs to go. And when he mentions his family, he doesn't seem to miss them at all, really.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's just sort of Bill being a doctor is meant to show us that he sort of has this very normal profession. It's a profession everybody kind of understands, at least, you know, the core of it. They don't know the what's in the med school textbooks. Yeah. But you know what I mean?
And not just know about it, but respect it.
Yeah, exactly. Like he's this respectable guy that stays home with his wife. We presume that this night that he has is not the average, you know?
I mean, he's particularly, even for a doctor, he mentions that he still does house calls and he shows his face when a patient's dead. You know what I mean? It's very domestic, very kind of like clean cut, good face forward kind of way that he does a job that already kind of gives off that vibe.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, what's the first thing somebody that is living that kind of life thinks when they find out that somebody that they're talking to is a musician? They're like, oh, great, this irresponsible person stays up super late, doesn't take care of their responsibilities. You know, it's two sides of the coin, right? Or, you know, just these two different things where they started off in the same place and just went in different ways, you know? And I think that's why Tom Cruise continues to say that he's a doctor, to remind people that he is normal, and to remind himself that he is normal, but mostly to remind the viewer that he is this normal, respectable person. And we can even see it in his choice of drinks throughout the movie. Whenever he drinks alcohol, whenever he has an option, he drinks beer. And when he only drinks liquor when liquor is not an option, whereas Nick and Sidney Pollack's character, is his name Ziegler, is that what you said?
Yeah, or Ziegler, but yes.
Yeah, okay. They're liquor drinkers. They're more experienced in the world of drinking, you know.
Scotch and gin and tonics.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Tom Cruise just has Bill has a beer when he gets home from work, you know, and
a Budweiser, a good American exactly. frat boy beer.
Exactly, like he's just supposed to be this beacon of normalcy. And that's why we continually get shots of Budweiser throughout the film, and why we continually get shots of Bill saying he's a doctor.
Okay.
To remind people of his normalcy.
Yeah. Did you put much stock into...
Probably.
Okay, good. Moving on. Yeah. We talked about those jobs as being normal and being, you know, respectful or not as respectful for kind of by societal standards. What about the role of status in this movie? Because we kind of have Bill as a doctor, you know, above everyone, like above someone like Nick, you know, and I wanted to point out that they're friendly too. Like, I thought that when he said, oh, this guy dropped out of med school, that Nick was going to be really reluctant to see him or like upset and kind of embarrassed that this is what he does now and he's not a doctor. But, Nick seems really happy to see him and, you know, invites him out and is happy to see him a second time and things like that. So, it's not that there's like a competition between the two at all. It just seems like they are so clearly different and just happy with what they do on their own and not, you know, not jealous. He's not, Bill doesn't want to stay up all night and party and drink. Mm-hmm. And Nick doesn't seem jealous that he has, you know, probably more money and is around his wife and kid all the time. Like, it's
they don't talk for very much in the film, but when they do, it's very friendly.
Yeah. So I wanted to say Bill's status kind of comes up a few times, and it seems, well, first of all, everyone wants to fuck Tom Cruise in this movie.
Oh yeah,
like,
definitely.
Like every single person I think he talks to that's not his daughter seems to have something on him. Yeah. But I think his status as a doctor plays into that. I mean, obviously he looks like Tom Cruise, but they do make a point of, you know, the fact that he is a doctor gets mentioned a lot. We see him at work. We see him kind of blow off patients to do his own thing. Mm-hmm. But he's not the top of the ladder, mm-hmm. because we have someone like, I think our first comparison point is when the handsome Hungarian man tries to seduce Alice, and, you know, you know, we think of Bill as rich and successful. He's got this nice place in New York, you know, by Central Park and all this and all these things. And he's you know, well-dressed. But there's often times where he is out of his league. And we have people who are much more higher in status than him, who have more money. It seems like Ziegler even is, I think, all the worst parts of Bill. Like if he was colder, if he was more focused on money, if he was okay with cheating on his wife, which, I mean, Bill barely is in this and has, you know, tons of regrets about it, almost infidelity. So, I just wanted to get kind of your opinion on what this movie says about status and wealth.
I think that's a big part of it. And I think one of the things I like about this movie so much, like even more than the idea of fidelity, I think this movie is about the idea of realizing there are some things in life that you shouldn't feel necessary to be included in. Like there are some things that where you're just out of your depth. I think that's an exact line from Ziegler in their last scene together, where Bill just doesn't belong here, you know? And
as that might be pretty close to what is said to him at the mansion too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like... and it's just, we get this guy that is, what happens is he has this argument with his wife, which is a great scene that we haven't discussed, but is a very, very good scene. And one of the main things that gets discovered in that scene is that his wife, Nicole Kidman, tells him about this fantasy she had with the sailor, and that for like a split second she would have given up her entire marriage and everything just for one night with the sailor. And pretty much immediately after that, he gets this house call to say his patient has died. And that sort of leads him out onto this journey that leads ends at the Fidelio Mansion. And what he's spurred on out of this world that he knows he belongs in, this world of a seemingly kind of happy marriage. They see, at least up until the argument, we don't really see any signs of distress between the two of them, just sort of normal marriage, the way we normally see marriage depicted on film. And even the argument is very realistic. Like it seems like a conversation a married couple would have, right?
Yeah, if Nicole Kidman could act, yeah.
She's really not good at acting drunk or high.
I know.
And that's the majority of her role in this film.
And it's so front loaded like that too.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Shows me off.
She never had a chance. I lost. Oh yeah. And so he's led out of this happy, warm place of this marriage by this anger. Right. And so he's like, oh, I'm going to do these new things to like show my wife, you know, like I can hang out in orgy mansions too. You know, I'm cool. And what the whole movie is, you know, him going, leading up to this point, and he's never really in control, but he's never super uncomfortable with what's happening. And it's only when he starts to revisit these things where he's made to feel totally uncomfortable and learn all of the things he didn't think about beforehand. Like, I'm going to take a cab to this place. Everybody else shows up in limos. And that's part of the reason he gets identified. He leaves a receipt in his pocket for something he shouldn't have, which is probably a pretty easy way to get caught by your wife cheating too. And the main thing that I think really points to this is that we joked about it a little bit at the very intro of this podcast. There is no second password. What he should have said is just nothing. He just shouldn't have acted when he was questioned about the password. I mean, I don't think that would have gotten him out of the situation any better than he does. But the main idea there is that he does something when he should have done nothing. And that's what we get throughout this whole movie with Bill, is him doing things that he just shouldn't have done. And slowly realizing that, and slowly coming back to the place that he left, realizing that these parts of life do exist, and I just don't know how to operate within them. And a big part of that is that, like you said, he is a doctor, and that's important. And he sort of views himself as somebody of a high status, somebody that belongs in these places. But what he, again, slowly learns is that there are people way more powerful than him. Every time Ziegler calls him in this movie, it's only twice, but it's like, oh, we need you upstairs, or we need you to come to play pool with me right now. You know, he goes immediately both times. And what that is meant to signify is that, yeah, he's an important man, he's a doctor, but he's still a servant. You know, he's still in service to some of these people.
Yeah, and I think for most of his life, and certainly for parts of this movie, when he is kind of in his zone, he's like big fish, small pond, you know, he feels great. And then he kind of is a small fish in the big ocean when he starts messing with all these, you know, the Fidelio Mansion and a lot of things that happen with Ziegler. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, that idea about there being no second password, it's just another thing in this movie where he's got it the first time, and then the second time through, he really loses it. And I think another good example of that is when he goes back to visit Domino, mm-hmm. and Domino's not there. And he doesn't understand the things that are just out of his view. Like he doesn't see this. He's when he doesn't find Domino and he finds her roommate, he's like, oh, well, I guess I'll just have sex with this person. And despite the fact that he is a doctor and seemingly an intelligent person, does not pick up on the fact he's about to receive some pretty bad news. Like, yeah. He's kind of like still kissing her and still holding her and all this stuff. And she's like, no, you might want to sit down for this. And he's like, oh, okay. Like, I know. It felt like he thought he was going to get a lap dance or something. It's like, no. There are things that you don't know. There is a world outside of your immediate knowledge that is very grave and very serious. Yeah, and he really misses out on that.
Yeah. He's in full Tom Cruise mode in that scene. Even like right down to his posture when he sits down in that chair, he's like spreading his legs, like full testosterone pose. Yeah.
DJ Mackey. Yeah. I have a kind of a reading on this, and I just wanted to get your take on it.
Mm-hmm.
About what we were just discussing. And I was looking at the poster of this. Is the cover of is the one of them kissing with her kind of looking off while his eyes are closed, was that what they used mostly in America?
Definitely, that is the one that has always sort of stuck in my head. I don't know if that was the primary one.
Yeah, I just remember you said you went and saw a bunch of posters.
Yeah, exactly. There was some that was just there was the Cruise Kidman Kubrick one that I mentioned. It was just Tom Cruise's mask from the orgy above that, and then
right.
Just the text. Thought it was a great poster. But yeah, I think the most common one, and certainly once it hits home video, it's that Kidman picture that you're discussing.
Okay, yeah, because that's the one I'm certainly the most familiar with too. Mm-hmm. So on that poster, the cover, it's, you know, them kind of engaged in something, but she's kind of got this wandering eye,
mm-hmm.
which I, you know, lined up with her fantasy, her memory of the naval officer,
mm-hmm.
and that scenario that Bill plays out in his head over and over throughout the movie and kind of gets tortured by.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like thinking of this movie as about like a fragile male ego and just that, like, of course your wife is always going to find other people attractive,
mm-hmm.
right? It's inevitable. It's part of human sexuality. Doesn't mean she's going to cheat on you, but she's still going to find people attractive who are good looking, even if you're literally Tom Cruise. But I think it's kind of like, I think there's a way to look at it as like this moral tale, like, oh, your wife still finds other people attractive, but don't go have sex with hookers or else you might get HIV. Don't go to religious sex parties because it might get you or your friends killed and puts you in danger. And there's just constant, I mean, he becomes really close to a lot of danger in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like nothing really that bad happens to him. Consider how close he is to a lot of bad things happening to him.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, like, I had this reading of, you know, don't be so fragile. Don't be so insecure about yourself as a man in a relationship. But then I kind of got hooked on the idea that it's not just she found someone attractive. Like Alice states, I would have left you. I would have left my child. I would have left our whole life, mm-hmm. which to me is more than just, you know, normal human sexuality. And that's like, to me, saying that really crossed, or maybe not saying it, but feeling it, I think really would cross a really problematic line for me, I think. So I just didn't know what you thought of that reading or if there is something about kind of jealousy and insecurity in this movie.
Yeah, no, I think that's part of what sort of sends him out. What we just talked about, basically, I think jealousy and insecurity is a part of it. And that's sort of you know, why he goes through this journey. It's like, oh, my wife can do these things. Well, I can do these things, you know? And I do think that's entirely tied to jealousy and anger that he feels out of that scene. And, you know, his male ego and wanting to maintain, you know, this sort of sense of himself as this strong-willed man, you know?
Yeah, but do you feel like Alice crosses a line here, or he's just the one that's being too weak about something and too insecure? It's a fault of his, not hers. And I mean, the answer is probably they're both wrong, because
yeah, that's I mean, that's the answer I'm coming up with, is that they eventually they're both wrong. She's wrong initially, and he, you know, goes through a bunch of things that I think are also problematic to sustaining your marriage. Yeah, I think she's wrong, and then he's wrong, you know.
Right. And something else I saw about production was Kubrick tried to create Cruise and Kidman apart a lot, and like shot that scene we were discussing, that kind of, I guess, the most dream sequence-y scene of this whole movie, when Bill is picturing Alice and this naval officer having sex. Mm-hmm. I guess for like a minute of footage, they ended up shooting like 6 days of naked sex scenes with a male model and like 50 different positions. And said, like, what didn't said he wasn't Kidman wasn't allowed to explain to Cruise like how the day went or like what shooting they did, and just kind of left it in his mind, much like Bill is in this movie, to like picture it himself and kind of make the worst of it, even if it's something that never even took place.
Yeah.
And I mean, as a married couple, you know, we talked about the importance of their real life relationship on the popularity of this movie. But I think that's a great example of their real life relationship having an impact within the movie.
Yeah. And the fact that just the way we know Kubrick worked, like that argument scene is a long scene. And to imagine how long they probably had to have that argument as a fake married couple, but professionally as a real married couple, like yeah. to sort of live in that headspace with your wife for a long time or your husband for a long time has got to do something something negative to your brain. Yeah
And I was thinking about this in the very last scene, the kind of epilogue scene, as you described it in the toy store. It's these two highly desired, attractive actors. You know, as we said, Cruise was probably the biggest star, and Kidman was a star in her own right, but, you know, married to the biggest star, which obviously is going to help. Mm-hmm. It's these two really, really popular, highly, you know, desired for actors expressing their desires in a toy store where their kid is running around, like pointing out her kind of more simplistic desires. And there's kind of all this like longing and wanting and regret, and but just like desire for something else. And then we also have their child, Helena, wants a baby carriage. And so like we kind of have this idea of relationships and parenthood and family and, you know, babies being an outcome of sex.
Yeah.
Just all kind of in this one little scene. And they really don't lean on that stuff too hard, but I really, really like that a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just added like a lot of emotion to the scene. And I've seen negative reviews of this movie describing it as kind of leaving you with an unresolved feeling. And
malarkey, I'd say.
I kind of get it. Like, I get that feeling, but I think it's the unresolved feeling of the movie is the unresolved nature of this relationship. Like, they haven't solved this for sure. Like. Mm. And I mean, the last line of this movie is fuck. Like, what are we going to do? Oh, we're going to go home and fuck. And that's going to solve things. I think she's aware, like, it's going to be cathartic and primal, and it's going to make things better for a little bit. But she's still reluctant to say forever. She knows that sex, which is such a huge part of this movie, is very important to a relationship and can certainly postpone issues, but very rarely is sex going to solve an issue. And I think that's why, as kind of goofy as that finish is, I think it's nice that it's that unresolved feeling, because this relationship is still going to require a lot of work, like all relationships do. Like, you're never at a point where you're out of work to do, and now you're just going to enjoy it. That never goes away. And, you know, in the way she says fuck and not have sex, like, it's this really primal, animalistic, raw thing that is going to, you know, release a bunch of chemicals in our brain that we love and trust each other for a little while longer. But we still have a lot of stuff to deal with.
Yeah, for sure.
What did you think of the mask on the pillow at the end, near the end?
Yeah, that's one of the things I don't it's definitely meant to be there as
guilt.
Yeah, exactly. And whether or not it's really there, because I forget Nicole Kidman's character's name.
Yeah, you do. Alice.
Okay. We'll get to why I continually forget characters' names in this movie eventually. But Alice never seems to point to it, never seems to notice it. We don't know if she put it there. She certainly doesn't seem to wake up and be like, ha, I found the mask, you know? She just has immediate concern for her bawling husband, which must be a very bizarre way to wake up. I don't think it's supposed to be there. I think he just sees it himself, you know, and he just sort of like imagines this thing there, you know, and it's just this total symbol of his guilt. It's the loose end that he didn't clean up. Cause you know, he didn't return the mask. He doesn't really know where it is. The only place that makes sense is that it's in his home. And where he, you know, initially put the costume away in his office. And I think it's just sort of, it's the loose end for his relationship with his, or, you know, telling all these things to his wife. So he sees it, he either sees it for real or just sort of imagines it in his mind, and it sort of spurs him on to tell his wife everything. Like, I can't live with these loose ends. Like, I need her to know these things.
Right. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. You have similar opinion on it?
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear it's guilt. I think there's a question of whether it's really there or not, because he takes it off at the mansion. That's the last we ever see of it. We don't get that shot of it like falling out of his briefcase as he goes to work one day. It could be a lot of places. It could be in his car. It could have just simply been misplaced. We don't have any certainty on that, but I think it's just kind of the blood on your hands that's not really there, you know?
Yeah.
It's the guilt.
Yeah, and tying into that, I mentioned in our Inherent Vice podcast that there's a lot of blue and orange in that film, and that I think was lifted from Eyes Wide Shut. There's a ton of blue and orange in Eyes Wide Shut, and what we see in the beginning of the film is this bedroom is sort of this really warmly lit room, and all throughout the house or their apartment, it's very warm orange light. And outside in the windows, it's always like this really weirdly vibrant blue.
Yeah.
That is the night, you know, even though that's not what night looks like when you look out a window.
No, it's like a vibrant midnight blue. Like it is that color, but just so more like luminescent. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, it's there, but it's outside of their house. And starting in the argument scene, you start to get these things linked together. And when Nicole Kidman, when Alice first gets offended in the argument, she starts backing up. And what she's doing is backing up towards the bathroom door, and she's making herself framed with a background of blue, because she's heard this thing that the person she loves most in the world has said about her. And she just sort of feels more lonely. And so she backs into this cold blue. Now, all throughout the movie, we get that sort of contrast. We get places where things are warmly lit and things are coolly lit. And but what's most important to know with those colors is that when he comes back and sees the mask on the bed, the whole bedroom is totally blue. Yeah. And it's like the outside world has totally taken over our bedroom, and it's this,
and
all these,
we've seen their bedroom even at night before in the movie, and it's not that color.
And there is a transition. Like it's done steadily. Each time the bedroom is shown, we get more blue in it basically until, the outside world kind of takes it over. And this lonely world that Bill has been, occupying, by himself, has sort of taken over the one thing that he had where he really felt safe. And that's his breaking point, is the blue has taken over his life. You know?
Yeah. And there's nothing more kind of domestic and adult relationshipy than the bedroom, right?
Like, yeah, exactly.
Of a family. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the color choices that you're describing are super intentional, because as I said, it's a Christmas movie. We see Christmas trees everywhere and Christmas lights, and there's so little red and green. Mm-hmm. Like, it's incredible for how much Christmas, you know, art direction there is in this movie. It's just we don't get our Christmas colors. And I think it's, you know, for the reasons you said, that there's meaning in these other non-Christmas colors. And I think that adds a bit to that kind of dreamlike kind of things are off kilter. It's like, you know, we have Christmas, but it never feels Christmassy. We don't get our normal Christmas colors. You know, we have shopping for gifts. We have Christmas lights. We have things like that. But it never feels remotely festive. And I understand part of that is the tone and subject matter. But I think they do a really good job of, you know, providing one thing, providing a lot of signifiers of one thing and then not filling in what the other things we're familiar with, those things being associated with.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the meaning of the placement of Christmas in this film and going on your point, we do see a lot of Christmas lights, Christmas trees in this film, but pretty much only in places where Bill feels safe. We see them at home. We see them in Domino's home, the cafes that he's in, the costume shop. These are places where he's certainly confused for a bit in the costume shop, but he never really.
But he's been there before, and he knew the owner before, and it's somewhere I need a costume. I'm going to go to Rainbow. Like it's a place he knows and was comfortable with.
Yeah. Even though it's not the same owner, he knows the place. Yeah.
But we don't get any Christmas stuff in the mansion.
Yeah, know? Exactly. And nothing. And even so the party, at the very beginning at, Ziegler's house, there's, you know, lights everywhere, Christmas lights everywhere, and they look amazing. But when we return to that home, or, you know, even in the party, the Mandy interlude when he goes upstairs, no Christmas lights in the bathroom that they're in. And yeah. When Ziegler and Bill meet again at the end in the study, I suppose.
Billiards room.
Yeah, sure.
to use only Clue terms.
Yeah. There's no Christmas stuff around them. And yeah. Christmas is sort of the symbol of being with your family, and the places where Bill is furthest from his family or furthest from the safety of family are the places we get no semblance of Christmas, you know?
And the most Christmassy one is the finale when he's with his wife, he's with his daughter. They've seemed to kind of at least overcome things to mm-hmm. the point where they're deciding that at least they're going to stay together and still have sex, it seems. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's those things line up so well as far as kind of good times, family, domestic things. Yeah, and I never noticed that Domino's was so, like, I noticed it was Christmassy in her place, but I hadn't thought of that. And that
there are even like presents on the counter in her kitchen.
Yeah, yeah, and like I know it's he kisses a hooker, and that's all that really happens in that scene. But like, it is an oddly sweet scene. Like that is kind of a time that you see him get along with someone genuinely that's not his wife. Mm-hmm. The rest is all very businessy or...
Well, and Nick.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do kind of like that that use of Christmas. And I think it comes together really well in the end with so many of the ideas of, you know, getting this domestic life back in order and being with your wife and child.
Yeah, for sure. One other thing about the just going back to the blue and green, or sorry, the blue and orange for a second, in the every time we see part of the dreams or Bill's imagining of the dream sequence, it's black and white, right? But it's black and white with a little bit of blue tinge. Yeah. It's not straight black and white. It's very clearly got an element of blue to it, and I think that's helpful. And in the argument scene, the way that whole scene is shot is amazing, but it's unsurprising. But when we start to get that point where we get that clear break from when Alice starts telling Bill this story, we've so far been getting angles that are kind of from the characters' perspectives. We get shots theoretically from around the position that Nicole Kidman would actually be looking at Tom Cruise and vice versa. Even when she's sitting down, we still get these POV shots of a really close up on Tom Cruise's face, just like you would expect her to be looking at him. When we break from that in Tom Cruise's perspective is this pretty much the second she starts talking about this naval officer, and we get this weird, very movie-ish shot from the side of Alice. And the first time I saw this movie, I was like, wow, that's a weird cut. That doesn't feel right. And the reason it doesn't feel right is because we're now suddenly getting the angle that normal movies would show us. It's just this very simple shot that just sort of gets the idea across. But what happens and why that angle is bizarre is that the perspective is broken. And we are with Bill now. Bill doesn't know how to look at this woman properly right now because it's totally changed his perspective. And he's suddenly on our side of things. And I think that's a really good example of something that where you can sort of watch for these small things throughout this movie where we're kind of looking at things through Bill's perspective for the vast majority of this film. Certainly from that cut onward we are. And I think it's fun to sort of look for those little things and Kubrick was good at those.
Yeah, for sure he was.
I kind of want to talk about Tom Cruise in this movie, and this goes to the whole why I suspect I can never remember characters' names in this film.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that I saw it for the first time pretty recently, but about 8 months ago now. I think this movie is about stardom and like taking stars down a peg, because especially if you look at Stanley Kubrick's career, he didn't really cast big stars very frequently. Like we've got Jack Nicholson in The Shining, right? But even that, well, I'll come back to that. But the reason he seemed to cast these lesser known people, you know, like what else do you know Keir D'Elia from other than 2001? Is the reason he would cast these people is so that they were sort of a blank slate, so that he could control the way we see these people, right? Because, you know, when you go see, say, Focus is coming out with Will Smith, when you go see that movie, you know how Will Smith is going to act in that movie. We've seen enough evidence that there's going to be... there's just going to be a sort of style to his performance because he's like a known person, like a known cultural thing, you know? And that's so hard to break out of. And that's why Kubrick would always cast these sort of, I don't know, these blank faced people, like even Ryan O'Neill, who's the lead in Barry Lyndon, like he was a person, you know, he's famous for Love Story and all these things, but he was still kind of a blank slate, you know? And Kubrick did this so that he could control the way we saw these people. And maybe the other notable exception for that is Peter Sellers, but Peter Sellers was always defined by how undefinable he was. Yeah. So, I mean, it totally fits in. And Jack Nicholson, it was sort of, we talked about this on The Shining, that people kind of perceived him as a little bit crazy. I think The Shining, certainly now is a huge part of that. But even at the time, I think just with the way his lips curl when he smiles, like he was, and one of his most famous movies is him being in a madhouse. And like that was very much a part of his casting. With Tom Cruise in Eyes Wide Shut and Nicole Kidman to a lesser extent, Kubrick is casting somebody that he knows nobody is going to be able to get away from their perception of him. So this whole movie is kind of a comment on our perception of Tom Cruise, right? And I find that so interesting. Like, he's the trusted voice that can bring Mandy back to life. You know, it's like this power of celebrity that can wake her up. And there are a couple moments in this movie where Tom Cruise says some things that are so Tom Cruise-y, but not Tom Cruise in this movie. Like when he sends Nicole Kidman into the laughing fit in the argument scene, she says to him, "You are very sure of yourself. Like, you're very sure I would never cheat on you." And he says, "No, I'm sure of you," which is something he would say in Days of Thunder, you know? And that's why, and she laughs at him because she knows it's all fake. Like it, and then she immediately goes into the story of the fantasy. Another example of that is when Domino, is offering her services, like, you know, "What do you want?" He responds with, "Well, what do you recommend?" Again, in a very Tom Cruise-y sort of way. And she immediately kind of like chuckles and rolls her eyes. And as he says, "I'm in your hands," you know? And the sort of reaction to these more movie-ish Tom Cruise-y moments in a sort of negative way. And Another great example of that is when we talked about it a little bit off the podcast. Those guys on the street accost Tom Cruise. What do? They say
all
he's
gay.
Yeah, they say he's gay and they say he's short, which were the two most common things said about about Cruise by his detractors in the 90s. And I think that that's so fascinating. And even Marion, when she says she loves Bill. Bill's response is that they barely know each other, but she would give up anything for one night with him because, you know, like he is theoretically her naval soldier, you know, yeah. She would give up anything for one night of him with him because he is Tom Cruise, you know? And I think that the whole movie is about that sort of, that perception of stardom and to put the biggest star in the world at the time, or, you know, one of the biggest stars in Hollywood in that place, I think really sort of accentuates that. It helps allow that to be something that exists in the film and fully accentuates it, you know?
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, we talked about it, everywhere he goes, people want to fuck him, but that's not what he wants at the time. Normally, like, you know, even if it's Alan Cumming behind the hotel desk, mm-hmm. or whatever, like, as much as he is, you know, going to this party that Nick told him about, knowing that there's sex there and that he kind of has infidelity on his mind for a lot of this movie. The fact that everyone knows him really plays against him. Like, he shows up at this party and everyone's like, oh, we know who you are already. Yeah. Like, you're not supposed to be here. Like, this isn't a place for you. And being famous and well-known and good-looking and all those things that often can have their advantages, you know, has disadvantages. And I think that... the fact that he's not getting what he wants, even like the fact that everyone knows who he is so quickly, and that prevents him from doing certain things, I think also plays into that idea of celebrity. And I think having someone like Tom Cruise, having someone that famous at the time, is, I think, ideal casting for that.
Absolutely. And when Bill finds out that he's serving somebody else, or sort of comes to the conclusion that, you know, there are things higher above him, you know, he's the highest, he views himself as sort of the star, Tom Cruise does. And the person that he realizes he's still serving is Sidney Pollack, a man that directs films. Yeah. And I think that's so great. I love Sidney Pollack as an actor in general. Like, I was never a fan of him as a director, but I always like him as an actor. There's some sort of presence that he has that I feel like always adds to a movie.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. And I think that's such funny casting because, you know, he didn't act a lot, but I mean, if Kubrick's going to ask you to be in a movie, you're going to say yes. But yeah, I think that that's really funny. And it's like Kubrick wanting to, especially with how we saw Tom Cruise had to sign an open-ended contract and it ended up being this 2-year shoot. And it's just like Kubrick wanted to show Tom Cruise he's just a normal man, you know, and he has to serve his master.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. I do also think Eyes Wide Shut is a bit more sort of like personal from Kubrick's perspective as well. Like, I think it's a movie kind of about his reclusiveness. Like, he just sort of, it's him, or at least justifying his never leaving the house to himself because there's only terrible things out there that can give him HIV. Yeah. And I do think it is a movie about reclusiveness or a reasoning for it. Just like I think it's him sort of saying to himself, like, I might hold this great dictatorial position when I'm at Pinewood Studios, but there are still people higher up than me, you know? Yeah. And I think from that perspective, it's interesting that he can get so much across about Tom Cruise as a star, himself as a recluse, recluse/genius, and still get all of the other millions of things that are in this movie across. You know, I don't know. This movie's amazing.
Good.
Yeah.
And fuck.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.